We're live, Z.
What?
Yeah. We're live right now.
I'm like
now.
One of those old guys. Huh?
Huh?
What's up?
Hey, guy.
Tom Sawyer. You're here. I'm having a stroke.
More of a Huck Finn. Really.
You know, it's funny. It's funny. Logan went live as I was responding to a text that's kind of important. And my whole mindset is like, wait, where the fuck am I right now? What's up, Z-Pack?
We went from talking about The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe right beforehand to what we're doing now.
Weird studio live stuff. So yeah. The boys are back in town. We shot like 20 videos. It's true. Had a good time. We ate a fucking delicious meal.
Oh my God, it was so good.
Paulsa. Something like that.
Puosa.
Downtown San Mateo.
I don't know.
It was good.
It was fancy. Zubin asked the waitress, he goes, there was like a pizza and it said like chicories.
Yeah.
And he was like, excuse me, you know, what's chicories? And she goes, oh, you know, it's like a reductio, a reduction, you know? And we were both like, mm-hmm, oh, yeah, of course. We don't know what that means.
Whereas Logan was just like, where are the burgers? What's going on? Yeah, both of us had no clue. And then she comes out, the pizzas are uncut.
Yeah, and they gave you scissors.
They gave us scissors, and they go, you know, because you realize in Italy, they don't cut their pizza. And I'm like, bitch, I've been to Italy. They cut their fucking pizza. Like, this is what kind of pretentious bullshit? So we were already triggered. We're like, this is a typical Bay Area horseshit. It was so good.
Yeah.
It was delicious.
It's like a radicchio reduction. That's what she said yes. to us. And I was like, sure. We all know radicchio, don't we?
You know what's really funny is like, so would you like tap or sparkling? And of course, me and Tom are both conditioned to go tap. Why the fuck would we pay money for sparkling? Yeah. And Logan goes, sparkling? And we're like, all right, fine. We'll try the sparkling water.
She brought out the fanciest bottle of sparkling water. It was still sparkling water. Like it was not moving.
Exactly.
There were no bubbles.
No bubbles.
And so then as soon as me and Zubin taste it, we're like, this is $20 bottle of water.
Exactly.
A bottle of water.
I was like, it was delivered in a snifter.
Yes.
I was like, oh, the bubbles are effervescent and yet so flat. I mean, it's like a perfect paradox. If this water holds paradox like the Bible holds paradox.
You said to me, this is a good sipping water, Tom Heineberg. You know, this is a real sipping water here.
I did say that. And I stand by that statement. Because, you know, what's funny is so then she goes, would you like a refill on that water? We had no idea what it cost. So we were like, you know what? No, that's dangerous. Go ahead and hit us up with tap. So she brings tap water in a fancy, like, you know, one of these little like carafes and pours it for us. And so I take it, forgetting that she's changed it. And I'm like, oh, my sipping water. And I taste it. And I was like, this tap water tastes like ass. Okay, now I'm permanently spoiled wanting this fancy ass. It turned out to only be $7 a bottle.
I know.
Yeah, I know.
Which is still expensive.
It is.
Yeah.
It did serve three of us, a small snifter.
One snifter full of water.
It's like deuterium. It's that valuable. Like you could actually power a cold fusion reactor in the 80s, a fake cold fusion reactor. Anyways, dude, what's up, dude?
There's a Kanye West song where he goes, what you ordering sparkling water? You know you wasn't drinking sparkling water before you came out here, you know, to LA.
Dude, that's perfect. We were talking about The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe and how neither one of us understands the deep magic.
Do you know that C.S. Lewis and J.R.R. Tolkien were good friends?
They were.
Yeah.
You know, what's also interesting is Douglas Harding, who is the guy who invented this headless way that Sam Harris talks about as a meditation, got his break because he sent his first book to C.S. Lewis. And C.S. Lewis, who was a devout Christian, said, oh, this is the most mystical shit I've ever seen. That's crazy awesome. And he was like, oh, shit, C.S. Lewis.
Yeah.
And then he gave him the courage to become a teacher of meditation. Who knew?
Who knew?
Not me. Certainly not Logan.
Did you read a lot when you were a kid?
I read quite a bit.
Yeah, me too.
Yeah.
Me too.
Yeah.
Do you think this is a prerequisite for success? Are leaders readers? Are readers leaders?
Well, I don't know, Tom Heineberg, but I did watch a lot of Reading Rainbow, and I figure that counts, too. Do you remember Reading Rainbow? Was that a thing when you were growing up? With LeVar Burton?
Yeah, but just barely. Tail end.
Oh, tail end of it. Yeah. No, it was big in the 80s.
It was more like reruns when I was a kid.
Oh, right. Take a book.
Yeah.
It's in a book. Mm-hmm. A Reading Rainbow.
Reading Rainbow.
I remember. Can go anywhere. I don't know why I'm doing it like an elf from the Lord of the Rings cartoon.
My school had instituted this reading program where like you would score, like you'd take a test on the book that you had just written and it was on the computer, and you'd just take, you know, you'd pick a book from the library, take a test on it, then you'd get a score, and it would tell you like what grade level you're reading at, and then you would be ranked against like the other boys in the class.
That's right.
So it was, it became a competitive thing where we were like, oh, I'm gonna outread the shit out of you, motherfucker. Oh yeah, you haven't read Little House on the Prairie yet, bitch. That's at an eighth grade level, son.
That's so when why we were you like, read Little House.
So we were in like fourth grade, fifth grade. Yeah, I would read the books that were at eighth grade level, ninth grade level.
Little Women.
Know? I would be like, I'm so much smarter than you guys. Look at me, I'm number one on the reading list, bitch.
You know what's funny is that Pareto distribution of reading superiority actually carried you to like a really high score on the SAT in verbal, right?
Yeah, yeah, yeah. When I had a, like basically 100%
yeah
on written and verbal on the SAT,
right?
But like a dog shit
-12
dog shit score on science and math.
Nothing
which
has changed.
Led me to an overall score of I think I scored 28 on the ACT, which I don't know how that.
I don't know what that means.
Yeah, I don't know what it means.
Yeah, I don't even remember. Yeah. That's like awesome.
36 is the max.
That's something. Awesome. And so then you like, went to UNLV and did film, and so it didn't matter because
didn't even need the ACT. Nobody even asked for the ACT.
They didn't even ask you.
No.
Oh shit, man. So we were talking about how Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe ought to be a. It should have been done differently. It should have been like a dark. Like HBO series, like Game of, yeah. The Game of Thrones producers.
Netflix. They should do like nine seasons.
Like
Netflix.
The Witcher, but...
Because there's like nine books, I think.
Yeah, know? There's a lot. Yeah. All of them are horseshit, by the way.
Yeah, Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe is pretty good.
That was everything. Like Prince Caspian. It's like, okay, this shit's falling off.
I
like
read the rest of them. Yeah.
I did too, and yeah. I was just... It's all Christian allegory, by the way. So in the end, they pretty much all die and go to heaven.
I know, I was going
except
to,
for the bad kids.
I was going to Catholic school,
oh,
and that's why, you know.
Nice.
That's why they wanted us to read C.S.
Could you imagine the Turkish Delight scene where the witch gives... gives him Turkish Delight done like Game of Thrones, like HBO style.
Yeah.
Like you just see this fucking witch who's just barely holding it together, trying to look fair and handing him this delicious delight that this kid cannot refuse so much so that he betrays his own family to this horrible person. It's brilliant. Oh my God, dude. Katie McLaughlin sent us 1600 stars.
What?
Clearly she likes Dark Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe.
Hell yeah.
Mm-hmm.
We're going to use that to jumpstart that project. Ronald says the Pizza Hut book reading program earned so many free personal pan pizzas. Do you remember that?
I remember that.
Yeah,
shit.
Me too.
Oh my God.
Me too.
Dude, the Pizza Hut in my town in Clovis was like the central hub. They had an arcade. So we would all go to Pizza Hut and we would order breadsticks because it was the cheapest thing on the menu and
yeah.
Sit there, eat breadsticks, nurse these breadsticks, and play video games all night. God.
Oh, let's see. Abby wants to know what is the thought on Corona.
Coronavirus,
yeah.
So, okay, so I just did a show on it today. We're going to release it either today or tomorrow. We
probably
should release
later,
it today.
Later today, yeah. Because
yeah.
It's very,
yeah.
It's happening right now.
It's happening right now. So this is my thinking on it. Like 300 cases, a bunch of deaths. The thinking is that this is the first time the Chinese government has gotten their shit together. When SARS came out, they all tried to hide it, got out of the bag. Next thing you know, you have this real worldwide outbreak. In this case, they're so ahead of the game that the virus hasn't even a chance to show mutation in genetic samples. So they really were on top of it. Are they overreacting? No, they're reacting appropriately to something that could easily change in humans to becoming so transmissible, that it becomes a pandemic, kills, you know, it's mostly killing people who are like, have COPD, diabetes.
What do you think about the idea of a global pandemic? Because I know Bill Gates has been out there banging the drum on this for quite some time, that like, it is coming, we're going to have a global pandemic at some point.
Yeah. You know what I think? He's right. At the same time, really smart people tend to overestimate and catastrophize scientific risk.
Mm.
I really think so. So like he's so smart that he can spin out in his mind all the possible scenarios that could happen. But statistically, what's going to happen is probably nothing or a pandemic that kills some people and then we figure it out and progress moves on. But so I think the truth is somewhere in between, but I think we have to be ready for it. Just like we have to be ready for antibiotic resistance. Where's all the antibiotic resistance coming from? It's coming from us giving antibiotics to cattle.
Let me pull on that thread a bit. If the truth is somewhere in between, does that mean that we've seen the last large scale pandemics?
Oh, I don't think
like things like Spanish flu.
Yeah, I don't think we can say that because Spanish flu could come back tomorrow.
Right.
It's just as a strain that humans haven't seen in a while. They're not ready for it. A lot of people die, and that one killed a lot of young people. So mm-hmm. Young people were preferentially dying. It was people don't realize that was a disaster, you know, and the Provax.
Oh yeah, it was like one of the worst.
The worst, right? Yeah. Because it's viral, it's not easy to treat, anyways. And back then, they had nothing. So,
what if the bubonic? This is, I'm going to just throw this thought experiment out at you right now. What if the bubonic plague happened like here in America today with all our, you know, modern sanitary conditions? Would it be as bad?
It wouldn't happen. I mean, you have little mini outbreaks of plague, like outbreak meaning like a case. And it's like, you know, there's a flea on a mouse that infects a guy and they treat it with antibiotics and they don't die. So it happens. I think what happened there is you have crowded conditions, no understanding of the principles of infectious disease. Mm. And again, once again, science, Science, science. Once you figure out how the world works or how our interface of the world works, you can manipulate it in a way that's beneficial.
Yeah, you know, I was reading like the Hamilton book, I think it was, and some outbreak of something, scarlet fever or something happened. Maybe it was typhoid. I can't remember. But, you know, he tried to go to like Philadelphia from New York and they had blocked off all the roads. And they were basically, Philadelphia was just like, you can't come. Yeah. We know you guys got fucking typhoid or whatever. You can't come
what
over
What else
here.
Could you do in those?
Yeah, exactly. I mean, that's that was the whole thing. It was just like, suck it, New York. Stay away from here.
You know what's crazy is what is Wuhan, China doing right now? Same fucking thing.
Same thing.
The same thing. So it's
really isolation is the whole the whole thing.
And the Chinese can pull it off because they're a autocratic state.
Yeah,
we couldn't do that here.
No,
you would have like it'd be an ET scenario where you have all these government people in these white suits. And
remember the Ebola and it was down in Texas and the whole thing. Like, just a few years ago.
The nurse got infected.
2014 maybe.
Wasn't long ago. Yeah. I did a song about it around then. I remember. Yeah. And and that thing. See. What Hotez was saying on the show, Peter Hotez, is that we're underestimating the effect of even the trials of vaccines on preventing Ebola because we haven't seen another huge outbreak. And partially that may be because we have these quote-unquote experimental vaccines that are actually quite effective, and we're seeing a decrease in the transmissibility because guess what? Secret, vaccines work.
Yeah.
Especially when they're mechanistically appropriate. So this makes sense. It's a virus, has a target. You can develop antibodies to it. People who recover have immunity because they have developed antibodies. So it seems to work.
Let me ask you this question. You know, and these are sort of the circles I run in online, so this is why I'm curious about it. I run into a lot of people.
Pornographic circles?
Yeah, hardcore.
We were talking about that.
It's there's a lot of people who, in the libertarian thought camp, who think that, you know, they don't want, just because vaccines are state mandated, they don't want them.
Yeah.
They think that if it's state mandated, it must be negative or harmful for their children.
Yeah.
Which is, you know, it bumps right up against the liberty versus oppression.
Yeah.
Moral flavoring.
It's a moral flavor thing.
And you have to overcome that to get past it.
Yeah. And you I think the way you overcome it is you have to appreciate it and go, okay, I get that. Bodily autonomy or liberty versus oppression versus care versus harm. So care versus harm says, no, actually, it's better for you to go ahead and take that needle because you're going to harm a lot of people. So you have to balance all those things, but you have to speak the language of the person whose moral palate may be different than yours. This is hard because it butts up against politics and religion and all these other things. We've had done shows on this. Why do we hate each other? We hate each other because we have the same moral taste buds, the same five or six flavors, but we value them differently and we interpret them differently. But if we acknowledge, oh, we're all trying to do the right thing except for psychopaths.
Well, it's kind of like the conversation we were having at lunch about cultural taste, like for food preferences.
Right.
And I always approach Z with this thing of like, I want to find objective truth.
So right, I'm
like,
the hardline truth.
So I'm like, here's the thing. I'm fucking right, Z. Everybody likes chocolate ice cream. And if they don't, there's just something wrong with them. There's not something wrong with chocolate ice cream. Okay. You know, and Z's like, well, you know, it's like culture and conditioning, Tom. And I'm no, they're wrong. You ever tasted chocolate ice cream? Shit's good, dog.
It is delicious. Yeah.
It's the same kind of thing. Our cultural baggage creates these moral flavorings, like, you know, the different preferences that we have.
Yeah. Cultural, genetic, upbringing, and even just experience. Like, I have changed my opinions on so many things. Like, I used to be hard line on a lot of stuff. Like, I am right, period.
Yeah.
Anyone who thinks otherwise is just simply wrong. And now I'm much more, I'm dogmatic about certain things, but other things I'm just like, oh, I can see all sides of that, which is a curse because then you can't argue very effectively.
Can I tell you this? I'm becoming more in line with this way of thinking that there is a lot of cultural conditioning that occurs, right? But then there's this secondary thought that comes right after that, which is, well, let's shape people to not be...
Right.
You know, like, let's basically... Like, there was a video of a Bernie Sanders supporter being like, you know, after Hitler in Germany, they had to re-educate all the idiot population not to be Nazis, basically. And this is like a way that people think, is like, we're going to condition people to be the way we want them to be. So right up front, you're like taking away liberty, you know?
Yeah, it's a tough thing to
kind of be allowed to be stupid.
Tough thing to condone.
Yeah.
Yeah, you know, it's like, that's why with the anti-vaxxers, this is my feeling. you should be allowed to be stupid, but that means that you pay some consequence. Yeah. So there's some systemic intervention that makes your life a little bit harder or a little bit less pleasant. And so,
which is, you got to homeschool your kid.
Homeschool your kid.
Et cetera. But we're further isolating them and we're creating like weirdos in that regard.
But you know, it's tough because the question is there already a momentum towards isolation and weirdness in a population that feels so convinced that the government and big industry is trying to poison them by injecting toxins into them?
We were having this conversation about, you know, sort of like mass surveillance and how our phones are listening to us at all times.
They are.
And that's that's a fact at this point, right? Mm-hmm. And a guy was telling us a story about in 2008, they were, you know, trying to find these always-on functions of this device and how much data they could extract from people's conversations, et cetera. And this was 12 years ago. Like, they've gotten so much better at gamifying us, right? And so, like, are we just walking through this sort of passive labyrinth where we're just, are we walking passively through this labyrinth where we're just being controlled? And, like, who's designing the labyrinth and why do they get to design the labyrinth? And you know what I'm saying? Like, I understand, like, follow your heart, but what does it mean to follow your heart in a world where your heart can be gamed by algorithms?
That's the entire thesis of Harari's, 21st,
right.
21 rules for the 21st century. He's basically saying this whole idea of liberal democracy where you vote your conscience and you follow your heart and the consumer is always right because they'll make educated decisions is horseshit when the algorithms know us better than we do, where our data is already being streamed into this cloud where it's being analyzed and, you know, everything from manipulation of elections one way or the other to what kind of, injecting smells into the mall so that you want to go to Aunt Anne's and get your, you know, cinnamon thing. It's all, we're being manipulated constantly.
Yeah.
In not unpredictable ways. So we're kind of human little biological machines and we can be tweaked that way.
And it's acceptable in some regards, right? Like, I mean, you know, you walk by Cinnabon and they get you with that good smell mm-hmm. and you go in and have a Cinnabon. Like, right. Okay, that's very acceptable. You know, they gotcha. It smelled good. It tasted good. It cost $5, whatever. Mm. You got gamed, you know? Mm. And that happens all over. But like, it's less acceptable when it's like about how you're going to vote.
Who you're going to vote for. Right.
Or
Or
you're going to send your children or how you're going to educate your children or, you know.
We have to have a degree of humility as humans and realize we're less free than we think we are to begin with.
Yeah.
But so we have to figure out from a systems level, how much is top-down architected? How much are we manipulated by corporations and other things? And how much do we really have free will and a free stay in this? I think it's got to be a balance where, like, look, vaccines are a good example. Like, if you tell people, hey, do whatever you want with vaccines, most of them are going to be like, that's a pain in the ass. I don't want to do this, whatever. But if you start to say, well, you can't really go to school unless your kids are vaccinated because it's not safe for the mass of kids. And there's kids that can't be vaccinated and that can get sick and die. Well, then people will do it. So you're not entirely free because you're being coerced a little bit.
Yeah.
So that kind of thing, I have a tough time really criticizing that because it is looking at a broader compassion, a rational compassion for a bigger group of people. At the same time, I don't want my freedoms impinged on. I don't want someone tying me down and injecting me with stuff any more than a libertarian does. So in the end, we have to keep having the conversation. Now, this is the problem. The end stage of that is when we silence the conversation. Then the game is over. Then we're controlled. Mm. And that's why I think all these motions on both the left and the right to control free speech, they need to be stopped.
Well, you know, Edward Snowden had a quote where he said that, you know, like you said, power is coercive. We are forced now in the modern age to stand naked before power. That's Snowden's quote. In a very real way.
Mm.
Like, we are just naked before power. We do not have the means to fight back. And the idea that voice or interior reform is going to let them give us our power back, it's never going to happen. Like, the only way to effect change is to fully exit the labyrinth that you find yourself wandering passively through, you know.
So this applies very much to our own movement, right? It's like we're in a labyrinth that's created
healthcare.
This labyrinth is created by forces that are so complex and so entrenched that there's no person you can blame. There's not even an institution.
And that's by design,
right? It's by design.
Because, you know, it used to be back in the day, you know, the king was fucking you and you went and you chopped off the king's head.
Exactly.
Right.
Now, who do you chop off?
Who's to blame? Whose head do you chop off?
Put United Health out of business, which I'd love to see, right? Because they're
horrible.
Somebody
else will pop up.
They're horrible. Someone else will pop up. Cigna will get bigger.
Mm-hmm.
Put, you know, Humana out of business. That's going to... Okay, put Pfizer out of business. What'll happen?
Yeah. Optum.
More stuff.
Keep going. Whatever.
Then what happens in government? All these industry people go into government because they want to serve people. They get all the information. They circle right back into business and they use that information to make connections and empower the businesses. So this is the American system.
Yeah.
Now, to fix that, First of all, because everyone goes in wanting to fix it. I know government officials who want to fix it.
We talked about this last night. It's like, but everybody who's smart, all the best Americans are on the make. They all want to get what they can for themselves and their families, right? Right. And they tell themselves this reassuring lie that's essentially a lie, which is, I'm going to go in, I'm going to affect change, and I'm also going to make a lot of money for me.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's nice to tell yourself that, but it's not real. It never ends up working out that way. What happens is you play the game, you know, you get caught up and you take out what you can get and then you split without having changed anything. All you did was siphon money.
And honestly, this was, we were talking about this last night, this was a crisis of confidence I was having.
Yeah.
Because a lot of groups pay me a ton of money to come speak. And I talk about all the things we talk about on the show. I do it authentically. I don't pull my punches, but it doesn't matter. And I tell myself, oh, I'm doing good. And it's true, there are people in the audience who are like, I've not heard this. This is the first time I'm waking up to this idea that I can be individually empowered to make a change in a system or step out of the system and do something. But in reality, aren't I just perpetuating? Because then the big system says, look what we did. We're doing this.
Look at Z-Dog MD. Mm. He danced like a monkey on the stage. Mm. Don't you all feel better?
Yeah. Yeah. Right, and then you get a sponsored episode where someone's making a gizmo that does this or that. And that's cool. But really, it's part of the medical industrial complex and everybody's hustling. So even I, who I think I'm so pure and I want to help people and, you know, that and honestly, that's why we've talked about this. And I've said this to supporters, people who fund the show. Like, this is why I had that kind of breakdown midsummer. I'm like, holy shit, I don't need to do this. Like, if I have a group of people that are willing to support what we do, we can say anything we want. And then the crisis is, well, now what do we say?
Yeah.
We have this power. And the thing is, we do influence people, but...
And where does that speech turn into action?
Where does it turn into action?
What is that action?
Right. And to be honest, if I'm being honest, I'm not the one to commit the action. I built a clinic. I ran it for 3 years. It was horrible, dude. Like, that shit was the hardest thing that I've ever had to do, and closing it was hard, but it was easier than opening it.
Yeah.
Because at least you said, okay, then we have the principles now. Our partners can go and do it. It is so hard. You're fighting every day. You're sitting with United and you're talking to them. It's soul sucking. So I'm asking people to do that. I'm saying, you know what? You should do that too.
As a person who's older and wiser now, I do understand like how hard it is for you to have done that, right? And that you can't be expected to go it alone. Because you're just going to get your head lopped off.
Well,
that's what happens.
Yeah, it's hard. You need to do it together.
It's a kamikaze mission.
Right. It is. It is. Yeah. It is. And you know, like they say, the pioneers always get the arrows in their back, right?
Yeah.
But the truth is, if you're a pioneer and no one's following, now the great news is people are doing stuff, right? It's reaching a critical mass. I say this again and again and again. We're at a tipping point where something's going to happen. Yes, you're going to have all the calcified bullshit at the top, but it's getting so bad that even the people at the top, and these are big business leaders, are realizing, you know, like the Warren Buffetts and these guys.
Oh, I think they want an exit. I think they want to escape the system as well because they're realizing that the guillotines are coming out.
They're coming, yeah.
And they don't know where to turn, where to go. So they want a way out. They're looking for a way out. Everybody wants the system to collapse. Everybody. Even the entrenched interests. But they want to escape with the gold.
Yeah, they want to run off.
They will.
Oh yeah,
that's going to happen.
They always do.
You know, but I don't think they want to be the fall guy when the Titanic hits the iceberg.
Mm.
You know, nobody's going down with the ship.
Mm.
They're going to abandon.
Well, you know, I think healthcare is going to hit an iceberg in two ways.
Probably already has. Right?
Yeah, well, it has. But the thing is, not hit enough of an iceberg where there's a popular outrage. I think that popular outrage is going to lead to a single payer healthcare system.
Oof.
Yeah, that will
worsening.
Well, it will codify. It will solve some problems, and it will make other problems worse, and it will create new problems. That's just the simple bit of it. Yeah. I don't think it's the answer, and I'll tell you, it's purely because I think we can do better than that.
Well, if we go to single payer, it seems like we're just hastening the collapse.
Well, what we're doing is we're copying the other people who've done this. They've had some success in homogenous populations with some challenges too. The thing is, we have a unique opportunity to do something uniquely American.
It's going to create more social unrest too when you go to single payer.
Well, what'll happen is there'll be a two-tier system.
Yeah.
Like there is now, really, but it'll be worse because you'll have people doing private insurance and you'll have people having the public option, and it'll be absolutely disparate.
Yeah.
So what they did in the Netherlands, they had something like that and it became unsustainable. And so they actually got rid of the public option. So this is one of the few cases where a single payer has been disrupted. So they had a single payer and they had a private sector, and it was all the good doctors were going to the private sector because they don't want to be slaves in a matrix, most of them. The very altruistic ones maybe stayed in the single payer or whatever it is. So what ended up happening was they realized there was a
problem. They don't want to be bureaucrats. I mean, you're a bureaucrat.
Dude, bureaucracy is a fucking poison. Yeah. And this is just me. This is my moral palate.
And nobody can change bureaucracy.
Oh, it's...
You will change to fit bureaucracy.
There's nothing that hurts me more than working with bureaucrats or dealing in a bureaucracy or being part of a bureaucracy or being slave to a bureaucracy.
Yeah, it's soul crushing.
It took me a long time to realize that because I used to try to fit into the bureaucracy and appease the bureaucracy. When I realized that wasn't me, I needed an out, right? And that's when I started making videos, and that's when I went to Vegas and I made a clinic that did not report to bureaucracy because it just did the right thing for patients. It was just too ahead. It was too early, right? Yeah. Who was going to pay for that, right? Our insurance company went out of business. So, but the thing is, what the Netherlands did is they actually privatized the system then. And so it was insurance companies competing and doctors competing and this kind of thing with subsidies and this and that. And it became a really interesting model. So I shared that article recently on the Facebook page. I thought it was interesting. The Germans have a kind of a thing like that too. Not-for-profit, private insurance competing.
If there's any ability to collude, though, people are going to collude. And they're going to use government as a tool to help them collude.
Sure.
Right.
Yeah.
So why give them the oligopoly on a silver platter when you just say, here it is, collude away.
Well, that's what Medicare...
Use us.
That's what I worry that Medicare for All is. You're codifying the oligopoly as it is. So the big health system and all those are just going to bill Medicare for All inappropriately. Because the way you make money then is you do more volume or you do it inappropriately.
Yeah.
And that's what they do now to Medicare.
I don't want to make this like one of my things I always do, but don't you think it's important to directionally to decentralize, like to disperse?
So,
because colluding around central hubs is just going to continue to create bureaucracy.
Yeah, I think healthcare works best
coalescing around.
So. When it's distributed, all healthcare is local.
Yeah.
And I think that
it's person to person. It really doesn't scale that well.
So we have that problem in our clinic. Like, how do you scale a health coach relationship? How do you scale a team dynamic?
If we were tech entrepreneurs, right, and we were going into our VC pitch, the first thing they'd tell us about our utopian dream of healthcare is they'd be like, I don't know, guys. I don't see the killer app.
Yeah.
I don't think it scales.
They'll say it won't scale. Yeah. That's what they told us. I don't understand. This is very human. This is what we were told. Okay, with Turntable. This was our model, just for people who don't know. Health coaches, doctors, licensed clinical social worker, pharmacists, all working together in a team in service of the patient, paid a flat fee to manage a population with no copays and no obstructions to care, whether we do it remotely, whether we do it in person, whether we do it in our teaching yoga studio, whether we teach them to cook in our teaching kitchen. It is about education, prevention, and social determinants of health and managing all of those humanly as a relationship.
Yeah.
Using the technology which we designed ourselves, the medical record, to pull it all together because it wasn't about billing because you didn't bill. So what we were told by people is, okay, so how do you scale this? How do you scale this amazing team dynamic? You don't. The way you scale it is you do something that's like mitosis. So you break off a piece of the team,
yeah,
and then you interview a bunch of other potential teams in another location, and then you regrow a cell with its own culture, yeah, that has a lineage, has a seed.
Splinter cells.
It's like a splinter cell. Yeah, like a splinter cell, like a terrorist organization, very similar. And then you grow it up there, and then you have a central hub that is simply a consultancy. So it just says, okay, here's our best practices that we know, take and leave. Now, you would disagree even with the central hub.
I don't even think you can have a central hub. I just don't think you can.
The problem with healthcare, though, is a lot of the services are duplicated. So you can centralize the ones that don't need duplication, like technology.
Yeah.
And then the other stuff, like the human stuff, you can't centralize. You know, you can't have centralized HR and all that. Is very, very hard.
I mean, centralization is kind of just like a byproduct of lazy infrastructure. In most ways,
it depends on the organization.
Like, it hasn't been well thought out.
Well, usually
it's just just throw it all in together.
The other problem is
we'll see how it works out.
Let's be honest. Humans are fucking stupid. When they get in these organizations, they dumb down to the lowest common denominator.
Of course.
They do stupid shit. Any nurse in my audience right now can testify to how stupid the fucking bureaucracy is.
And there's a diffusion of responsibility.
Always.
Nobody's in charge.
Yes. And you advance by being politically expedient, but not necessarily good at what you do.
Yes, exactly.
And so it's not a meritocracy.
You just look ahead. You see the people that are above you. You please them. You move a level beyond them. You please them. You move a level beyond them. You please them.
Yeah.
Suddenly you're at the top. You're like, wait, what? Why did I get to the top of this organization? Might as well milk it for as many millions as I can. Then I'm going to bail with my golden parachute.
Uh-huh. But you don't think that way. You think in terms of, oh, I'm providing a lot of value and I paid my dues and I climbed the ladder. That's how you think, because otherwise you wouldn't be able to function. And the truth is, we're only as good as our incentives. So when you're paying people to do things to people, you're going to do things to people. When you're paying people to do nothing, like certain salaried positions, like, okay, the less you do, the more your effective pay per hour is. That's very counterproductive.
Yeah.
You have to structure it in a way that actually encourages people to do the right thing. And I think to a degree, peer accountability is important. So the idea that you're accountable to your team, your specialists, your primary care people, your patients, and they hold you accountable. We hold each other mutually accountable. That's kind of awesome. I saw that in Kansas, actually.
Peer organizations are great, right? Because they know what's like, and especially like niche peer organizations. Can't be just doctors, can't be just nurses. It has to be, you know, your subspecialty, a doctor or nurse, because they know what was appropriate in your circumstance. You know?
Yeah.
And things coming under peer review would probably be better than being decided by some central bureaucracy.
Yeah. You know what? I just had an idea for my new talk. So in the new talk, I wanted to point out, okay, here was turntable. Here's why it failed. Here's the struggle. Here's why we suffer moral injury. Here are the people who are overcoming it using these tools that we talk about. And so when I went to Kansas, I saw this crazy shit where administrators and clinicians would huddle together each day and they would talk about, okay, here's the administrative side. Here's how we keep the doors open. Here's the patient stories. Here's what's happening to our patients. How can we make those align so that we're paid to do the right thing for patients? And it was really remarkable. I'm going to hit them up and see if I can get some images and put that in my talk and highlight that, because I thought that was really well done. And they used telehealth in an actually very human way, because the person was in the hospital there, beaming into the patient room using that Banyan product.
Totally.
And there's cool stuff happening, dude. Like, I think if we really show people, it can be done.
Human ingenuity is boundless.
It is.
But it's being constrained.
It's being constrained by bureaucracy, by incentives. And the thing is, government can actually be a helpful force. So far, it has not been.
Yeah, it's not just government. You know, I mean,
it's industry.
These corporations are bureaucracies, too. And they're crushing the human spirit and human ingenuity.
Actually, corporate bureaucracy is the worst.
Yeah.
The worst. Here's the thing. Like, I love the Kaiser model. I actually think it's a beautiful model. I love the doctors. I love the leaders.
Mm-hmm.
I hate the corporatization and the bureaucracy of it. It's so hard to navigate. And so do a lot of the people in it. But they still are believers in, we can do this. Even though it's a big ship, we have to switch it around. At least they're trying, right?
Yeah.
So they're actually a great hope for doing things right.
Man, it's like... Another problem with these large centralized healthcare players is that there's a tremendous amount of technical debt that goes along with them. And what that means is basically, like, when you have a top-down hierarchy who's making decisions on how resources should be allocated, they're going to mismanage them. And they're going to mismanage them in a way that way overshoots. And you're going to have to undo what happened there.
Mm.
As opposed to when things bubble up, you know, in smaller teams, it's like your cellular mitosis. Well, the cells that aren't going to be capable of dividing, well, they don't divide, right?
Mm. So there's a book about a new way of managing companies that talks about this. So this idea of top-down management, first of all, it depersonalizes humans. It reduces them to commodities.
It is natural, though, because we've always had top-down hierarchies.
It's a natural hierarchy. Right? It's a top-down dominator hierarchy. Yes. The people at the top dominate. But the thing is, you can get to a next phase where, okay, I get it. I get dominator hierarchies. Now let's move to the next phase, which is a distributed holarchy, which is really more of everybody's doing their piece in a web, and the ideas bubble up. Anyone can lead in theory, but they lead in their own space. So imagine you're picking an EHR for your organization. Right now it's a top-down. A CIO gets pitched by Judy Faulkner from Epic. They spend $1 billion on a shitty implementation of Epic, and they destroy their business like MD Anderson did.
Yeah.
So that's a disaster. Now what happens if you get the bubbling up of the doctors and nurses and dietitians and everyone on the front line using it, and they go, these are the things we really want to be able to do. Can we design something like that? And then they hire some programmers and they do it. I'm not saying this would work, but here's a different way of doing it. And everybody's on the team in a way, and they spend a little bit of time working on it. I think it'd be a lot more effective. Now, the thing is, you can get paralysis by too many chefs. And that's something that like Tony Hsieh has experimented with his whole archy at Zappos, where there are no bosses. And it's tough because most people still need a boss.
And you still fall into your natural condition response, which is to fall in line in the hierarchy, especially men. You know, we have a real, we need to know our place in the hierarchy.
We need to know who's above us and who's below us.
Yes, exactly. Yeah,
it's really true.
You'd be like, well, I'm this guy, and you know, but Steve is fucking below me.
Steve.
Dumbass. But you know, Bruce, that guy is handsome. He's way above me. You know, it's a natural thing with guys where we fall in line in the hierarchy. I don't think it happens as
it's different with women.
It's a different social
dynamic. But yeah, so now you have to manage men and women, you have to figure out how this hierarchy works. Try to transcend aspects of the hierarchy that are non-productive. And the other thing is, like, how many people feel completely devalued going to work? Most people hate going to work.
Yeah.
It's just not a thing.
No.
They tolerate it. That's sick. We spend most of our time in work. Like, how can we expect to be fulfilled on any Maslow's hierarchy if we hate going to work? I mean,
well, and this feeds into the diseases of despair thing that's gaining traction all over the place.
Yeah.
Like, we are the most, this is like, everybody is sad.
Yeah, yeah.
Everybody is desperate. Everybody is depressed. Yeah. Everybody you talk to.
Yeah, yeah.
You know?
By the way, I mean, I see some comments here. I actually think like if you took Epic and you implemented it using this bottom-up approach where people actually spend a lot of time, which we don't have, you could actually have a great EHR. I think so because it's robust enough that you could do that. But how often does it get implemented like that? And you know what's interesting is when I was in Kansas too, they were talking about that. So they have a direct line to Epic and they hash it out back and forth and their doctors push back and they get stuff done.
Yeah.
So it can happen.
What's like Jack Dorsey, the CEO of Twitter, he put out a tweet a while ago where he said, you know, I'm working on a decentralized version of Twitter where Twitter is just a client. Like it's a decentralized social media protocol and Twitter is just one client on the protocol, but other people can build on the protocol and see what they come up with. You can imagine that something like that for healthcare where like there is a EHR protocol, EMR. We can go back to calling it EMR
because it's
now
a
protocol, right?
Yeah, yeah.
So like it's an EMR protocol and Epic is just a client on the protocol. Athena is just a client on the protocol and the new clients emerge upwards. You know, like there's a Linux type client on the protocol.
So this is...
Right? That's an open source thing.
Yeah, this is what Jonathan Bush was talking about when he was at Athena is that...
He was trying to create this.
He's like, why do we have software? This is the 21st century. We don't need software. We need these open
apps,
backbones, apps that plug in and make it seamless and facilitate it.
What he was talking about,
because all healthcare is local.
Yeah, what he was talking about though was still going to be controlled by Athena.
Because he has to make money.
Of course. And what I'm talking about is, although he's not at Athena anymore, so maybe he's down with the open plan architecture.
You know what he's down with now is direct primary care.
Yeah, yeah.
So he has a company that's facilitating direct primary
care.
What
I'm talking about is about just having a protocol that you can have different clients attached to, which I think is going to be the future.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
You know?
So how would Twitter then regulate, say, Tom's behavior on Twitter? They wouldn't?
No, you could regulate my behavior on Twitter, but I have the ability to leave the client if I want to, right?
And then where would you go, though, for Twitter's?
I'd go to a different client.
I see. But it all plugs into the central Twitter thing?
No. This would be a protocol. And then Twitter's just a client on top of the protocol.
Oh, okay. So the protocol is this open source thing.
Just like, you know, TCP/IP runs the internet. Like
right.
There would be a protocol that runs Twitter and then everybody could connect to it.
I see. You know? But you could have a competitor to Twitter that you could use just easily on that same protocol.
Exactly.
Like you could use Internet Explorer versus Firefox versus and Chrome.
The really hard thing that nobody wants to have the conversation about, especially in technical circles, is we have to have a full rewrite of the internet stack. We have to rewrite the internet.
Now you're basically living Silicon Valley, the series.
It's true though, because the way the internet is architected is going to continue to centralize in these oligopolies and you know, healthcare, same thing. So like, we're gonna need to own our data going into the future. Mm. We're not just gonna be able to wander through these passive labyrinths and just be poked and prodded and give away our data for free for basically for cheap likes. You know? Mm-hmm. You're gonna be able to own your data as a, like, you know, all your health data will be with you, secured in an encrypted file, and it goes with you wherever you go, right? Instead of like, God, trying to talk to the, you know, you're like, why don't you, like as a patient too, especially in the modern world, as a younger patient, you know, I'm like, why don't you guys fucking have my x-rays? I don't understand. Why didn't they get sent to you? Why didn't they get emailed to you?
When I first moved to Vegas, that was one of the problems I was looking to solve, is this decentralization of data, or the centralization of data in these silos means that Because what I experienced as a hospitalist is I would never get my patients' fucking records.
Yeah.
And it's deadly, you guys. Like, it's not even a joke. You're not only are you costing money, but you're killing people because you don't have the data that's already made. They had that CT scan. You're going to radiate them again to repeat it and then find something dumb, incidental, misread it, and end up causing harm? No, that's a terrible idea. But here's the question. So this is what I want to understand. It, as that protocol, would a blockchain type and a ledger make sense for electronic medical records where apps plug in using a central kind of a blockchain where you know when a chart is updated, you have a ledger of what's going on. It's when it's altered, you know what's happening. The patient controls it.
You could, but you don't actually need a blockchain because a blockchain is a triple entry ledger. You only need a double entry ledger.
It's a blockchain light.
Just traditional Medician accounting. You just need a MySQL database that has everybody's information. Now, the problem is who has control of that database, right? So the blockchain distributes it between everybody, but you don't want everybody to have your health information. This is why categorically every healthcare or medical-based blockchain company is full of shit. It just doesn't work. We need a full-stack rewrite of the internet in order to get access to or enable to keep control of our information.
Will that ever happen?
In the next, 50 years, I think it's going to happen. But it's going to be a slow slog to get there.
Yeah.
Because tech debt. The internet was built in the way it was built, and now we have to undo it because it wasn't it didn't come out correct.
Right.
We didn't anticipate all these problems that we were going to have.
You know what I think of it like? Evolution.
Yeah.
So in evolution, there's a lot of shit that really doesn't make sense in how we're structured, but it happens that evolution went down a path, and the only way it could get to an eyeball is by doing it in a real roundabout way.
Exactly.
So the nerves, like for example, the retina, the optic blind spot shouldn't exist, right? If you designed an eye, you would put the nerve up here.
Yeah.
But instead, because of the way that that unfolded in development and evolution, we have an optic blind spot.
Fascinating because people would be like, well, then, of course, top-down system. You should architect systems top-down. It's like, yeah, but you don't even know you need an eye.
That's right. You don't know you need an eye.
Yeah.
You don't know. And evolution only knew it needed an eye because of the bottom-up pressure and top-down pressure to survive.
Yeah.
So people, the things that could see would survive. They would have an evolutionary advantage. But you, in the beginning, evolution doesn't predict anything because it doesn't have an intelligence.
Yeah.
It's a process, right?
And there is, and you know, we can't escape the fact that there is human decision making at the inception point of all human systems.
Like correct.
Law, governance,
that's right.
Tech, health,
and that's all medicine. Flawed.
Yeah, exactly.
Even our constitution has flaws in it, exactly. Which is why technically you amend it, but it's so hard to amend.
Yeah.
I don't know, Tom, did we do a thing here?
I think we figured it all out, man.
We figured it out. Let's read a few comments real quick to reward people who've been with us this long, the 270 people who are still here. Adam West says, yeah, but no one wants to put in the work to fix it until it comes crashing down and it's absolutely necessary, which is dumb. Also, Adam, I'd say this, no one's financially rewarded for
there's no incentive to
fix it. If someone was paying them, then they would. One of the Epic people came in today and helped me set up, Jody Chance. That's a positive. Epic, look, the people who set up Epic are good people. The people who run Epic are probably good people. But it just could be done so much better. Peggy Mulford, yes, it virtually exists, but your primary and secondary keys get complicated. Are we talking about blockchain here, Peggy? Because that was one thing, Tom, like, couldn't you act, cause the way you access your money in Bitcoin, you use a key, right?
Yeah.
Why can't you do that with health records?
A private, because it's endogenous to the Bitcoin blockchain. You know what I'm saying? Like, Bitcoin exists only on chain. Health records exist outside chain.
Okay, could you make them exist only on chain? No, because
that's a really hard problem. Because
you could copy
it. No, I think the answer is no. I think, you know, truthfully, there's no use for a blockchain except for Bitcoin. People just haven't wised up to that fact yet.
Got it.
You know?
But you're a Bitcoin maximalist, so maybe you're biased or maybe you see
the
truth.
No, I looked at how the system works. I happen to read more than other people about this particular issue.
Yeah, yeah.
And
yeah,
I didn't read some tech VC's bullshit blog on Medium about it.
Did you hear the guy we had on the show was like, these are the three buzzwords, blockchain, AI, and cyber.
Yeah.
In health right now, none of it means anything.
It has the reason the Bitcoin blockchain works is because, and this is like a whole thing, but because the Bitcoin is the mining reward that securitizes the network.
Yeah.
So when miners contribute hash power to the Bitcoin blockchain, they are rewarded in Bitcoin, the token, and the token has value on the network. So you can't pull tokens and blockchains apart. You have to have a token.
I see.
Because otherwise, there's no way to secure the network.
So they're intermeshed.
You're accepting trust from third parties if you don't have a token.
Got it.
Right. And the only token that has any value is Bitcoin. That's why Bitcoin maximalism. You know what I mean?
That actually makes sense.
Yeah.
Now, here's another interesting thing we can wrap up with. Kimberly Gale, Z-Dog, and I haven't read this yet, but I think it's interesting. I'm in a situation where my family makes too much money to qualify for Medicare for my daughter, but not enough to afford, probably Medicaid, she means, but not enough. Oh, shit, I lost
Medicaid,
it.
Poor people. Medicare, old people.
Old people, who That's are also right. often poor people.
That's how I remember it.
So we were forced to accept a plan with a high deductible, and now I'm forced to decide between getting care my daughter needs and affording bills. For families like us, Medicare for All sounds like a lifesaver. What are we supposed to do? Medicare for All won't work, but the current system is forcing families to choose between their health and paying bills. For a family like mine, Medicare for All sounds like a godsend. And you know what, Kimberly, for a family like yours, it would be. And this is why what we do is you first of all fix the care model, because I bet you some of the stuff they're telling you your daughter needs, she doesn't need. And the stuff she does need, she's not getting. The second thing is, if you actually fix a care model, you make it more affordable, we could subsidize at higher income rates coverage for people who can't otherwise afford it. That's the idea. Everybody wants universal coverage.
Yeah.
It is absolutely, listen, I don't care whether healthcare is a right or not. I don't even care about that. I think everyone should be covered because it's just good for the country. It's good for the economy. It's good for our fellow human beings. So just fucking do it. Like, look, you don't have a right to my services, Tom. You don't right. have a right to my healthcare services. Right. But I think you should have access to healthcare, period. It's just bad for everybody if you don't. So let's set up a system where we do that. And Kimberly, I'm really sorry that you're struggling. You're not alone. I mean, I forego care because I know it's going to, I have a $7,000 deductible. You do the same thing. Yeah. Doctors are doing the same thing. This is a huge problem. So anyone who says the current system should just continue is smoking the crack. So I don't disagree with you, except that I think we can do it even better than a Medicare for All.
I agree.
Yeah.
I agree. It's lazy to say we should just have single payer.
I think it's despair.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think it's like Kimberly. She's like, fucking.
I know. Well, yeah, of course.
She's even saying, I'm reading between the lines. She's saying, I'm with you. I know it would cause problems, but it would be a godsend. And I hear her because that's what, in other countries, the populace is generally happy because they're like, I don't have to think about another thing, right? I just think we can do better. I think we should do better. So
James Stagg says, we issue everyone cloud-enabled secure storage that doesn't seem scalable. You know how Hillary Clinton had a personal server at our house?
Right.
I do think that the future is going to be we all have a personal server at our house where we host our own data.
Interesting.
You know?
Is that a feasible thing technologically?
Yeah. Technologically, we will have boxes available. You'll just buy a box.
So would a robber then steal the box and decrypt it, or?
Well, if you could get it decrypted, I suppose you'd have to break some pretty secure.
You need like a quantum computer.
You always have to think about security as like it's a cost benefit analysis, right? So like, could your standard mugger, could he afford $250,000 worth of computers to break into your encrypted device?
Yeah.
And the answer is probably not.
Yeah.
So there's a certain level of encryption. Now, could a nation state break into your device? Of course.
Yeah.
They could do whatever they want.
Yeah.
And you can buy these boxes now for like $30,000 that can break into any iPhone.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah. Police departments all across the country have them.
Interesting.
Right.
I didn't know that. That's interesting.
Did you keep up with the story that Apple is scanning all of our iCloud photos?
I didn't know that.
You don't know that. They say for pedophilia. But it's like, okay, but what else are you scanning them for? Also, I didn't give you my permission.
Wait a minute,
to scan
they're
my
scanning
phone.
Our everyone's iCloud photos. I'm going to cancel
because
iCloud.
Because it's not your
that's
server.
That's just a violation.
It's their server.
I see.
They scan through all your shit.
Oh, and that's why everyone wants to be in the cloud. Amazon Web Services. Uh-huh. And all these. Oh.
You control the cloud. You control everybody's computer. The cloud, there's no cloud.
Yeah.
The cloud is just someone else's computer.
That's right. Yeah, what cloud?
There's no cloud.
It's a fucking server at Switch in Las Vegas.
Right, exactly.
Right. It's a hard drive in a basement somewhere.
Exactly.
Holy shit.
Yeah, they've been scanning everyone's iCloud photos.
You know what? I want to congratulate both of us on this episode. You know why? We didn't mention consciousness once.
Nice.
Not once.
We mentioned Bitcoin, though, so I win. But I tried not to. Z asked me about
it. No, I was interested. this is great. I think we did a thing here. I want to thank everybody for sticking with us on this one. And for people listening on the podcast, dude, hit a fucking review. Why are you so lazy? When you review the podcast, bumps us up in the rankings so we can keep up with the world-class podcasts like Peter Attia and these guys, man. Rogan and other bald clown like myself. And if you want to support us and keep us independent, become a supporter. I see all the supporter comments in here. I'm so excited. You guys are fucking awesome. Really. Mm-hmm. Means a lot, right? I mean, we're pretty cynical motherfuckers.
Yeah.
But we never talk shit about our supporters.
I love the supporters.
Yeah, they are awesome.
I love anybody that hangs out and watches the content because I think everybody here is trying to... Everybody who's interacting with this sort of content gives a shit.
They give a shit.
And that is... Dude, okay, listen to this. That is step one. if you don't start out in your life or in any endeavor with rational optimism that things can get better, well, then just kill yourself. Because that's the end point.
You're
without,
done, yeah.
Without optimism.
Yeah, yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
Like, you wouldn't get married and have children if you thought this is all going to go to shit. You know what I mean? Like, you wouldn't do anything. You wouldn't start a new job. You would just sit there and then eventually kill yourself.
I actually think we're going to get so many angry emails. I'm kind of depressed and you pushed me over the edge. It's actually more than this.
No, I'm just saying be rationally optimistic. You know?
Right. And I'll say this. Rational optimism is almost never a cognitive distortion. In other words,
yes, you almost, it's rational.
It's rational.
Right.
You never lie.
Pure optimism is I'm going to win the lottery.
Is a cognitive distortion. Pessimism, frank pessimism, is usually a result of a cognitive distortion. Either you're catastrophizing, you're using all or white thinking, you're overgeneralizing, you're overpersonalizing. Yes. There's a list of distortions. But rational optimism is a clear-sighted vision of, hey, you know what? Not only can things get better, they have to get better because that's how I'm going to make it happen. So that's what I love about you guys. And I don't know, Logan, do we do a thing? Should we... We did a thing. Tom and Logan.
Yeet.
Z-Dog together again. I have a dream that someday.
Yo, put the stick in the box. Put the lick in the box. How's that song go?
How's it go? It's a dick in a box. I don't know.
Listen to The Box by Roddy Ricch on SoundCloud.
Roddy Ricch. All right, fam. We out. Fade to black.